Hello and welcome to The Bagel Bite with me, Hayden Cohen. So here we go, over 6 months into The Bagel, and I've avoided the dreaded topic of antisemitism, and with good reason. In the past few centuries, Jews have been defined by their hardships. The Judaism I aspire to, however, is one of joy of life, joy of family, joy of community. And yet, the spectre of antisemitism cannot be ignored. Quite frankly, it's impossible to be British, Jewish, and not have an opinion on antisemitism. For this bite, I had the pleasure to be joined by Guardian columnist, heavy metal sociologist, and wild-haired Keith Carne-Harris, who has a new book out on, you guessed it, antisemitism. One quick note before I hit play. When recording, Theresa May was still the Prime Minister, and that was only 2 months ago. Anyway, enjoy. I'm joined by sociologist and writer Keith Carne-Harris. We've known each other now for a few years round about the Limud world, and we kind of hit it off because we're both, I feel like we're kindred spirits, but in different ways.
There's no one kindred to me. I'm a completely unique individual.
But you're a sociologist. No one's unique.
No one's unique. No, we're all just aggregates of personalities. Anyway, nice to be here, Hayden. Thanks for having me on The Bagel.
I feel like we're getting weird to begin with, which is great. Yes, I know that you've got a new book out. It'll be out by the time this podcast airs for sure. It's one about antisemitism. I did actually hear a rumour that you said that you would never, ever write another book about the Jewish community. And here you are, writing another book about the Jewish community.
I'm not sure I ever said that, but I might have done when I was deep in the midst of writing another one. I think we've reached the point whereby anybody who writes about Jews can't really avoid writing about antisemitism. But I think what might be slightly different about my own book and my own writing on antisemitism is my starting point isn't antisemitism. My starting point is Jews. And I think a lot of the time when people write about antisemitism or think about antisemitism, that the antisemitism itself becomes the heart of the story. But actually it should be Jews at the heart of the story, because it's Jews that antisemitism affects. And it's from my interest in Jews and what they do, and in particularly my interest in the way Jews disagree with each other, that I came to be interested in antisemitism. I mean, how could you not at the moment? It's pretty hard to avoid it.
I think you'll probably try hard enough. I mean, I think there is a certain number of people who just kind of shrug the shoulders and get on with life, no?
Well, I think everyday life in Britain as a Jew, even if you are very affected by what's going on in terms of antisemitism, is still livable. I don't think antisemitism in this country has anywhere near got to the point where it is impossible to live a quote-unquote normal life.
Do you think it will?
Not in the short term. I really don't think so. A French-type situation is possible, but even in France, not everybody lives in the sink estates on the outskirts of cities and has to deal with that very present violence. And even those who do, it's not permanent, it's not all the time. But to say that isn't to take away its seriousness.
Right.
But yes, I think it is possible to live your life in Britain and antisemitism doesn't dominate every waking thought, unless you work for the CST, in which case it's your job.
The question I want to ask is that when you say that the starting point is Jews, how do you get away from the fact that that might sound that you're blaming Jews for antisemitism?
I think there's always that risk. The problem, it's a bit of a dilemma. On the one hand, if you look at antisemitism as something that is totally independent of anything Jews are, anything Jews do, it's not very realistic. You're failing to look at the complex ways in which antisemitism impacts on Jewish life. On the other hand, if you're too Jew-centric, then you neglect the fact that Jews are, after all, the victims here. So getting the right balance is, you're right, it's extremely difficult. But let me say a bit more.
It's probably impossible.
Well, it's impossible to do anything perfectly, let alone write about antisemitism. But let me say a bit more about what I meant by starting with Jews. What I've been interested in for years and years is conflicts between Jews both conflicts in a sort of theological sense, but also increasingly conflicts over Israel. And if you look at conflicts over Israel, which was the subject of my 2014 book, Uncivil War, then the issue of anti-Semitism isn't very far away. And what has struck me about the controversy over anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and also controversies about, more recent controversies about anti-Semitism on the right, is that they can't be separated from the fact that they are causing, and to some extent are caused by, conflicts amongst Jews. So if you look in the Labour Party, you have a particular set of Jews saying there is not much problem or there's no problem at all. And you have other sets of Jews, the majority, who are saying there's a major problem.
And I think it should be noted that it is the vast, vast majority.
Well, I don't know what you... problem is, I don't like to say things like vast because...
You mean it because it's not an absolute measurement?
No, it's not an absolute measurement. I mean, I think as far as we can tell, somewhere around 10, maybe 15% of the Jewish population in this country are not just passively not Zionist, but actively anti-Zionist in some shape or form. Now, I'm not saying that all of them are members of the Labour Party or Jewish Voice for Labour or anything like that, but that's more than a dozen people.
Right.
And I've always tried very, very hard not to draw boundaries over the Jewish people. There may be Jews who I deeply disagree with about many, many things, but they're still Jews. So I'm trying to resist that temptation. But yes, you're absolutely right. The majority of Jews in this country and worldwide are, at the very, very least, support the principle of a Jewish state and are Zionist in some shape or form. And that means that they're inevitably going to be concerned in some shape or form about anti-Semitism that comes in the form of anti-Zionism. But there's also a similar thing on the right, which is, and we're not seeing it quite as much in the UK, but we definitely see it a lot in America, where white nationalists and the far right are also doing the same sort of thing. They are hugging a particular sort of Jew close, a minority of Jews, it has to be said, but not an insignificant one, and rejecting the concerns of the rest. If you're a far right Jew in America, Donald Trump loves you. The Christian Zionists love you. If you're a right wing government in Israel, they love you. But if you're a liberal Democrat voting American Jew, your concerns don't really matter very much.
Which isn't that very similar to the current state of the Labour Party in that we're getting... It does feel like, and I know you've talked about this before, the good Jew and the bad Jew.
No, it's exactly the same. I'm saying that if the both left and right play this game, although it plays out differently in different countries. And I think that's one of the things that, on a personal level, been driving me mad for quite a long time, this good Jew, bad Jew game, because I think it's dangerous.
Although sometimes it's a bit fun, right?
Well, it's fine when Jews play that to a degree. It's fine. You know, we can joke about this stuff. There's jokey good Jew, bad Jew games.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I don't think what's going on in the Labour Party is that jokey. It's not something people want to joke about, or on the political right in America and in some other places.
It's about who's doing the joke.
It's about whose joke it is. I mean, it's like many Jewish jokes you'd be horrified by if they were told by non-Jews, but it's fine if it's told inside. So yeah, it's that good Jew, bad Jew thing that I think is very poisonous. And I think whilst it's not unique in the history of anti-Semitism, represents a new phase, if you like. In my book, I call it selective anti-Semitism. And it's what's interesting about it is it's a mixture of philo-Semitism, of love of a certain sort of Jew, and anti-Semitism. So I spell selective anti-Semitism anti/Semitism.
So can I ask then, because I've just wondered this, and you've written a whole book on it, so you should know the answer. Why is it anti-Semitism and not just racism?
Well, good question. I actually make a bigger argument in the book. I say that selective anti-Semitism is kind of in the vanguard for an emerging wider selective anti-racism. Increasingly today, both racists and anti-racists pick and choose the people that they want to defend, the minority groups they want to defend, and those they want to damn. And they do it in two ways. Either they select some minorities and not others. So it's quite common on the right to defend Jews against anti-Semitism, but to be Islamophobic, or in addition, selecting particular minorities or even majorities within groups. And what we're seeing is the early stages of this happening, certainly with regard to Muslims. So I've talked about this stuff in Muslim settings, and they absolutely identify with it, because the good Jew, bad Jew thing is certainly happening in the Muslim world. And
do you mean in terms of they talk about good Jew, bad Jew in the Muslim world, or do you mean good Muslim,
I'm saying the wider world is separating out the good Muslims and the bad Muslims.
Fine.
They're often different ones, as is in the Jewish community. And it's a very understandable thing in some respects. What it's doing is it's weakening the idea that anti-racism is universal, and that we defend people even if we don't find them particularly politically sympathetic.
I can remember when I was at university, there was this big debate on should we use the word tolerance or acceptance and celebration. But actually, tolerance is perfectly legitimate, right? You know, we tolerate people who we don't necessarily agree with, but we understand that they might do things in a way that we don't. But that seems to be evaporating.
I think so. And I think what's happening is that it's becoming intolerable. For example, with regard to Labour Party anti-Semitism, the fact that the majority of Jews are Zionists in some form becomes something that is so impossible to reconcile oneself with that essentially leads to selective anti-Semitism. So you decide that only certain kinds of Jews should be listened to about anti-Semitism.
Right.
But it's not exclusively left-wing. It's happening on the right as well. And it's part of a process, I think, in which the idea of a universal anti-racism, a universal tolerance, if you like, is becoming increasingly difficult to achieve. And Jews are kind of at the foreground of this. I'm not saying here it's Jews' fault, but I'm saying that selective anti-Semitism is kind of a canary in the coal mine, if you like.
How so?
Because what is happening to us at the moment, that pick and choose good Jew, bad Jew game, threatens to overtake many more groups and to prevent the emergence of any kind of universal anti-racism. And there's always been this tendency. There's always been this tendency. Racists have always found at least a few individuals who are exceptions to the rule. So plenty of white racists had a soft spot for Frank Bruno, if any of your listeners are old enough to remember Frank Bruno. Selective racism, selective anti-racism is more than that. It's not just choosing the odd exception. It's choosing whole groups of people. So that group of Muslims are okay.
Right.
That group of Jews are okay. But that group, we can't stand. And it's a really baleful process. And I think what's happened to the Jewish community in recent years stands as a warning to what will happen to other groups if we don't make a broader effort to fight this thing.
See, it's interesting because obviously, like pretty much every member of the Jewish community, I've been reflecting on this for quite a while. I used to be quite charitable, and I used to think, well, what's happening is that people are confusing terms. So I've found this a lot because I'm a performer. I've found that I seem to attract quite a wide range of friends and connections from across the political spectrum. And when anything comes up about, I mean, it's specifically Israel and Zionism, there is a confusion as to what the difference is between Zionism, anti-Semitism, and not liking the Israeli government. And I used to think that that was a naivety. I'm becoming less charitable because there's a point, isn't there, where when a community stands up and says, we don't like how you are talking to us. And I know you might not like the collective we, and there's plenty of issues with organisations that are there to supposedly represent all of us. But when enough of a community stands up and says, sorry, we don't like the way you're talking to us, and then everyone goes, no, we're not listening to you. I'm not sure, as someone who is pretty good at debating, is pretty good at wrestling with arguments, I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, the situation's pretty far gone. I think there's still people who are genuinely ignorant and whom you can have productive conversations, provided you don't have them online. I think, which raises the broader point. I think a lot of this, a lot of what's happened, in fact, the majority of it, can be put down to online culture. I'm not just saying it's all Facebook's fault or it's all Twitter's fault, but I don't think the situation would be anywhere near as bad were it not for that. And one of the things it does is that it forces you down these rabbit holes. It makes people who might otherwise have been perfectly capable of dialogue and learning to become incredibly defensive. That's Jews as much as anyone else. And a lot of these debates online, if you could call them debates, are incredibly sterile. They just circle out of control. They get angry and no one trusts anybody. So no one thinks that anyone is speaking in good faith. And I think that has led us to where we are, which is where the debates got stuck, if you like, where it's become predictable. One of the things I tried to do in the book is to try to not be entirely predictable, because so much writing, including writing that I 100% agree with, is so repetitive because this whole anti-Semitism controversy is incredibly repetitive. So under those conditions, to go back to what you were originally saying, having a nuanced discussion about what Zionism actually is and what the relationship between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is goes pretty much out the window, which makes me feel very sad because I believe deeply in dialogue and in education and in listening and civility and all that kind of stuff. But I have to be realistic. We've reached a point where it's very, very difficult to see how that can proceed.
Well, maybe I'm more naive, but I do have this sense that you have a look at the polls. Corbyn isn't doing as well as someone should be against Theresa May. You know what I mean? Like whatever your political opinions are, you would have thought at this point. But then I suppose the argument is that to do with anti-Semitism? Is it more to do with Brexit?
I think it has more to do with Brexit. I mean, I think, look, we're sitting here in Finchley. It's very clear that Jews are not going to be, most Jews will not be voting for Corbyn in Finchley. But the Jewish vote in Britain isn't actually that significant. It's because the Jewish population is so concentrated in a few locations. So, and they're not that many of us anyway. There's around 300,000 of us, depending on how you count it. And I think there are other reasons why people don't necessarily vote for Corbyn. I don't think there's been a mass sense of sympathy with what's been going on with the Jews. And I don't. That's not because of anti-Semitism. It's partly because at the moment there's so much else going on.
Right.
You know, this is one, for Jews, this is central to us. Whether you're pro or anti-Corbyn, if you're a Jew, this is something that is absolutely central to us. And we have, but not everyone's a Jew.
There is a feeling as well when I see something about anti-Semitism in the media, that in the non-Jewish media, that I do feel like we're kind of being played as pawns, and that I'm not sure big newspaper exec really gives a toss.
Well, no, but a big newspaper exec, his or her job is to sell papers.
Well, yeah.
So that applies across the board. But it's look, more than one thing can be true at the same time. It can be true that there is a major anti-Semitism problem in the Labour Party. And it can also be true that Labour's political opponents are, this is an absolute massive gift for them. Mm. And that's why when people defend the Labour Party and say, well, the issue of anti-Semitism is being politicised. Of course it's being politicised because it's a political issue. And the only answer to that is that nobody should say anything negative about any political party ever. And that's not really a very practical kind of suggestion.
But isn't that the overarching point? In terms of, you have in political leaders at the moment, ones who are fans of authoritarianism, of doing as we say, not as we do, and this whole idea of individualism, of some form of dissent against authority, is trying to be eroded away.
So I'm gonna give a partial, very partial defence of the Corbynite Labour Party. I think there are various different strands within it. I think there's a highly authoritarian strand. I think Seamus Milne is highly authoritarian. Len McCluskey certainly is. I'm not sure Jeremy Corbyn actually is. I mean, he only got into this position kind of by accident. John McDonald might also have authoritarian tendencies, but there's also a... And this is one of the reasons why I think it's so sad what's happened, is that that we have to take seriously that a lot of people, particularly young people, were really enthused and energized by this. And there was some sense, at least, of a movement that was diverse, idealistic, and not centralized. And it's still there a bit. But I think that in the long term, it would have been crushed. I mean...
But Corbyn didn't get into power because he was an anti-Semite. He got in there because people wanted change, in the same way that Trump got in America, right?
He got in there for positive reasons and more negative reasons. I think the positive reason was his apparent plain-speaking down-to-earthness and his lack of polish was a very refreshing change.
Wait, are we talking about Trump or Corbyn?
Corbyn, I'm talking about Corbyn. No, he has, look, we can't deny that he has some like characteristics that people find likeable, right, and that after the slickness of New Labour and after what eventually became of it, it's kind of understandable why people wanted something different. And also after the 2008 economic crash and after the Iraq war, there was a groundswell of support for a change in direction, including, I mean, even Ed Miliband was taking the party a little bit more to the left. So I think that there was a desire for something different. I think that people didn't vote for Corbyn other than small minorities because of his history of pro-Palestinian campaigning. Some people might have voted, particularly Jews, might have voted against him for that matter. But it wasn't really a factor. And...
Well, I was at, you know, Marlon Solomon.
Sure.
Yeah, so I was at his show. If you haven't seen it, it's very good, about lizards and anti-Semitism. And I don't want to spoil anything. Just if you get a chance, do go and see it. It's very, very good. And there was a Q&A at the performance I saw. And there was someone there from Momentum. And they said, and it stayed with me, that I didn't join Momentum for international politics. I joined because I'm a teacher and I wanted something radical done in education.
Yes, and I'm very sympathetic to that. There's something unpleasant about Labour Party culture that I've never liked. And I don't think...
Me too. As a fellow ex-member, me too. You know, and I don't mean me too in the feminist. I mean me too in the literal sense. There is this quite aggressive, non-collaborative approach that I found. I don't know.
I mean, it's possible that this is the case for all political parties at all times. But I kind of, and I think...
I expect more of the Labour Party.
That's exactly it. And I think that's what you just said, I expect more of the Labour Party, is at the heart of a lot of the anti-Semitism stuff.
It's like, when I've seen people, and I've done the debates online, I know, bad idea, but you see people go, oh, well, the Tories are bad, you know, the Greens are bad, Lib Dems are... I don't care. I am a member of the Labour Party, or I was, and now I'm not. I expect Labour to be better, and they have failed.
I think they could have been better. I mean, I think that some of this is... Some of the anti-Semitism controversy, I like to think that there might have been a narrow window of opportunity to manage it better had it not been for Brexit. And why do I say Brexit? Jeremy Corbyn was elected as Labour leader, I think, September 2015. The Brexit vote happened, I think it was early June 2016. So he hadn't even been in office for a year. 3 days after the Brexit vote, there was the coup against him. And when I'm not sure it was the majority, but many of his MPs stood against him. And at the same week, the Chakravarti report was released under very difficult circumstances. So what essentially happened is the anti-Semitism issue became defensive about it because they saw a counter-revolution coming against the Corbynite project. But it did terrible things to the Corbynite project because, as I say, there was a side of it that was fairly diverse, heterogeneous, idealistic. And that side might have had a chance to do better were it not for the defensiveness. And as it is, a lot of really people I really respect just came into defensive mode and shut down. And any criticism of Corbyn, they would not tolerate at all. I remember before the Brexit vote, in fact, three or four months after Corbyn was elected, there were Corbynites talking quite openly online about saying, look, he's a placeholder. He will steady the ship, and in a few months we'll have a more substantial, more competent leader who's younger. people don't talk that way now. It's become so focused on Corbyn generally. And to say anything about it, including anti-Semitism, people, his defenders, won't tolerate any criticism.
Isn't a lot of it, though, a certain sense of ineptitude, which actually offends me more? In terms of, if he would have come out and actually believed this and said something along the lines of, you know, I've been in Stop the War, I've been, you know, I've been in pro-Palestinian organisations, because quite frankly, Palestinians have been treated quite badly, very badly, since the inception of Israel and beyond. And I've seen a world that doesn't care, and I do care. But that doesn't mean, just because I'm opposed to what is a right-wing government in Israel, that has nothing to do with the Jewish community. And anything that I might have done that looks like that, I apologise. It was my doggy determination for you know, Palestinian rights. Wouldn't that have been more... But he never said anything like that. He never even tried to say why he... He never tried to explain the journey that he went on.
Because so he's not the sort of person that goes on journeys. I mean, I think I think he has...
Maybe train journeys.
I think he has positive qualities, but...
To be fair, he makes amazing horseradish. I have had some and it is very good.
You went to the Judas Seder?
I didn't. Someone bought some of the Judas horseradish on eBay and put it in a potato salad, which I had at an Uffruff a few months ago.
You know, when you're an old man, it'll be like Cable Street. It'll be so like everyone would have claimed to have eaten Jeremy Corbyn's horseradish.
But I have. You hear it here. Yeah, exclusive here first.
Look, he's the whole competence thing is fairly bewildering. I think he has said things condemning anti-Semitism, but the problem is, and again and again and again, he speaks in generalities. And whilst he has a proven ability to connect with a certain type of person, for those people who are not his natural constituency or people he doesn't fundamentally understand that well, his ability to schmooze them is limited to non-existent. And if you look at the meetings that was had with the board and with the JLC and stuff, they look absolutely excruciating because he clearly didn't know how to communicate with them. Even assuming that he did so in good faith, and who knows, his ability to talk to them is limited to non-existent. He has skills, but that is not one of them. And I think there's another thing as well, which is he's heavily dependent on people behind him who are much smarter than he is and much more ruthless than he is, people like Len McCluskey and Seamus Milne. He is not a political operator. He's not a machine politician. And that means that when he genuinely does want to do something, he doesn't necessarily have the institutional competence to actually do it. He's quite passive-aggressive as well. If you've spent decades of your life being a self-defined anti-racist, he can barely keep the frustration that he is being accused of something that is antithetical to his very sense of being. And all of that makes for a very problematic mix.
Is it something about the, and I would say the uniqueness of antisemitism, in that whereas most racism is directed downwards, you know, someone taking away, you know, someone taking jobs, but taking the poor jobs so poor people can't work, or, you know, doing violent crime, those type of things. That Jewish racism is more to do with these wealthy people, these people who are in control.
Well, certainly now, and since the 19th century, anti-Semitism has shifted quite a lot. Of course, Jews have occupied lots of different class positions, from the very rich to the very poor. But since emancipation, since the 19th century, Jews became feared or hated because of their presumed power. And that's when you see the start of Rothschild myths. Well, those don't date back to the 18th century, but they really come into their own in the 19th century.
And now,
of course. Or Soros. If you're right-wing, it's Soros. If you're left-wing, it's Rothschild. It's also that I don't think that a certain section of the left can really understand what happened to us in the post-war period. Partly because it's working with a model of victimhood, whereas victimhood leads to a kind of sanctity. Whereas Jews suffered enormously, and yet they drew the quote-unquote wrong lessons. They sought worldly power rather than renunciate. And I think there's a certain kind of person on the far left who can't forgive that, nor the fact that certainly in Britain and America too, the majority of the Jewish community became upwardly mobile, educated, middle class. There's something about that. Someone like Corbyn is a massive philo-Semite. He loves Cable Street. He loves the idea of the Jewish working class, the Jewish history of communism, of Bundism. And you know what? That's a history to be proud of, and I'm proud of it as well. But
I think my granddad was there.
Of course, everyone's granddad was at Cable Street, along with Jeremy Corbyn's parents, just like everyone was at the Sex Pistols at the 100 Club in 1976 and the Cavern to see the Beatles in 1961. He could definitely identify with that strongly and passionately, and he identifies strongly with those who are the contemporary heirs to that. But the fact is that that's not where the majority of Jews are, whether you like it or not. You have to be pragmatic about it. That's where the majority of Jews are now. And that's the danger of philo-Semitism. And of course, on the political right, particularly in America, philo-Semitism is also based on a fantasy image of the Jew as this sort of heroic Islamophobic fighter against the Muslim hordes. And when Jews are not like that, they're massively disappointing. I think a lot of people are very disappointed that Jews don't fit the model that of what people want us to be. Which in some ways I quite like. I quite like our awkwardness. I quite like the fact that...
I think that's it, isn't it? That when you think of Jews, well, when I think of Jews, I think of awkward.
Yeah, we are awkward. We're frustrating.
Yeah.
We're maddening. Certainly we're maddening.
Speak to my wife. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Exactly. Well, we are maddening. And that's both the thing, one of the things I love about the Jewish people, but it's also we suffer for it.
Why do you think we're maddening?
Because any generalization you can say about Jews, you can find multiple case studies of the opposite. And not just that, we don't shut up. We're mouthy, you know. If you say, I like Jews, but your definition doesn't include another kind of Jew, that Jew will always come up and say, wait a sec, I'm here too.
Right.
And that's amazing. Mm. You know, our mouthiness, that spirit. It means that awkwardness, we definitely pay a price for it. It would be much easier if we were totally homogeneous, if we kept a low profile, if we didn't interact much in the world, and if we just stayed unified. But we haven't.
Would you say that awkwardness is because we're always in the minority? So in Israel, Israel doesn't come across to me as an awkward place because Jews are the majority. Is that unfair?
Actually, I think Israel's very awkward. Because it doesn't fit into easy categories. So, like, you know, people call it a settler colonial state, and to some extent it is. There are parallels with imperialism, but there are other elements in which Israel is completely the opposite of that.
Right, largest gay populations in the world, I think?
Well, not just that. Also, like, a continuous Jewish presence dating back millennia, right. Which is not the case in terms of Europeans who colonised Australia. It's got an incredibly strong liberal wing. It's got an incredibly strong reactionary wing. It's almost anybody can find an Israel that they love, even if it's an anti-Zionist Israel. That vitality is amazing. It also attracts a certain amount of hate. I think people want to put Jews and Israel in a box. And I think it causes us pain when people try and do that.
So... it feels now we've been talking a lot about the problem. Do you ever talk about the solution?
Oh, talking about the problem is much more fun.
is there a way back, or is it just going to get progressively worse and worse and worse?
It depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about the Labour Party as an institution, or if you're talking about the anti-Semitism, racism issue more generally. I think that for better or worse, I'm not sure I see much of a way back under Jeremy Corbyn. That doesn't mean I think the problem comes down to Jeremy Corbyn. I don't think it's entirely his fault. I don't think he's entirely control of the situation. And I don't think, for what it's worth, that he's a Jew hater to the core. But it's become so personalised that while he is in charge of the Labour Party, a very wide swathe of Jews will have no truck with it, or be at the very least extremely suspicious.
Would it be any different with a John McDonnell character?
I think there would be a modest improvement under John McDonnell. I think what I would want is a new generation coming up without that baggage, who perhaps has seen what happened here and wants to box clever.
Isn't that a worse problem? So at least with Jeremy Corbyn, you can go back and you can see what he stood for and you can see that type of thing. Whereas with someone with boxing clever, and I'm doing air quotes, I know, with boxing clever, does that mean that they actually think exactly the same way as Jeremy Corbyn, but they're just better at playing the media game? And arguably, isn't that worse?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that, I mean, I talk a bit about this in the book. To some extent, you can think what you like about Jews, provided you know that you have to get along with them. And you have to, if you're a politician, you have to represent them too. And
do you? Because you said before that our vote is small. So politically speaking, do you?
Well, not in that sense, you don't. But if you want to be a proper anti-racist, I mean, I suggest I'm coming back to some older virtues that are very, very unpopular at the moment. And I can't quite believe, because they're really antithetical to everything I've always believed. Values of self-restraint, stiff upper lip, even repression to a degree. Self-restraint, certainly. I think that we're living in a world, particularly with with online culture, where everyone says what they think the whole time. Actually, a certain amount of gritted teeth, getting on with people, and a bit of cynicism might actually help things a little bit.
I can remember the famous saying, right, that it's better to be alive than right.
Right. There are a lot of people that are right at the moment, but it's killing us all in a way. I think there's a big problem that goes way beyond the anti-Semitism controversy, which is how to deal with online culture. And I think we're at the start of a very long journey with that. I think it has revolutionized politics, sometimes in a good way, mostly not. And I don't think any of us really know how to deal with it. Certainly institutions. And in this, I do have some sympathy with the Labour Party, is that as an institutional challenge, you get this inundation of screenshots and complaints, and there's so much of it. And how are you supposed to institutionally process it? And I know that in universities, they're starting to have this problem as well, because they're having to make very difficult decisions about what students or academics say online. So it's not just political parties. I think we're all working out how to deal with this stuff. It's possible that we should just, if we all get exhausted enough, maybe we'll just all of us log off from Twitter and Facebook, and then we can actually go back to where it was before. Not very likely, though.
One of the reasons why I engage on social media, and I am one of those prolific engagers, is because it's not because of the person I'm engaging with, it's because of the other people reading it. So, you know, I'm aware that when I post something on Facebook, there are factors of people who read what I say but would never like or comment on anything. And it's for those people that I go, well, this person has said something that is just outrageous to me. And if I don't say something, that goes unchallenged and someone thinks that that's okay. Is the solution to that not saying anything?
Sometimes, but not always. I struggle with this massively. I know that when I try and stop myself, I see stuff all the time that horrifies me. But I know that most of the time, if I get into it, I will likely regret it, because it will end up taking an enormous amount of time and emotional energy. It'll be upsetting, and it may well ruin existing relationships.
So where's that line then? So, you know, I wouldn't want to be friends with Tommy Robinson, right? So if, and I'm not saying that your friends are like Tommy Robinson, but I'm just saying, at what point do you say, well, what you believe, even after I've told you that it is offensive and here's why, and you clearly don't want to listen, at what point do you go, well, maybe I shouldn't be friends with them anymore?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's going to be my next. But I mean, I don't think people say I don't know enough.
Right. No. For sure.
And this is, I think we have to be humble here at the fact that we're dealing with stuff that where we're all groping blindly in the dark. Having said all of that, I have had interactions online that have gone in surprising turns, just as I've had innocent interactions that have turned sour and spiraled out of control quickly. I've had difficult interactions that have actually ended up being interesting and illuminating and coming to some place of mutual respect. So it is possible to do that, and it does happen. And I also take your point that some arguments can't be left alone, that they have to be, even if it does nothing, just ethically, they have to be counted.
No, I'd say beyond the ethics, I'd say that it's not about the person that you're interacting with. It's about the people who read the person that you're interacting with, because that's the model of social media. You know, everyone sees it.
Yeah, there's a definite point to that. There's a definite point to that. I mean, but the other issue that's very difficult is distinguishing between people who are trolls and people who are just passionate in their opinions. Mm. I think it's maybe most of us have a bit of a troll in them.
Oh, I definitely do. I've got a big one. It's good fun sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I've even done it. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm necessarily trolled, but I have sometimes taken the piss out of people online. But it doesn't necessarily make me feel very good about myself.
No.
But, you know, maybe it's one of those guilty pleasures. It's like eating crisps.
It's like I always, every so often, when I see an argument, this type of thing, on Facebook, Twitter, and I just can't be bothered engaging with it, but I feel like I have to say something. I do quite like, I don't know if you've seen the animated GIF of Michael Jackson eating popcorn from Thriller.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of my, I feel like it's for every single online debate. Post that, makes you feel a lot better.
Yeah, sometimes being silly helps. I mean, sometimes just being ridiculous. I do, so both my Twitter and Facebook accounts, they're not consistent. Sometimes I do really serious things that I've thought deeply about. But the last thing I posted on Facebook was a ridiculous video by an amazing Scottish power metal band that I thought was hilarious and that everyone should check out. And I like to live tweet Eurovision, you know, things like that. So, you know, it can be, and the internet can be a hell of a lot of fun. I mean, I remember did you watch over Christmas the Bros documentary, the Matt and Luke Goss documentary? It was hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious. And it was just like a big Twitter party of people joking around about it. And then you start to think, yeah, people can be pretty cool too.
Right. I'm in a Game of Thrones Facebook message group. Called Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Excellent. I appreciate that. I have tweeted about Game of Thrones occasionally as well. So, yeah, it can be good. And actually, sometimes showing that side of yourself, if you do serious stuff, balancing it by showing less serious stuff shows that you're a rounded human being. You know, and also on Facebook, which is a bit more intimate than Twitter, I also post pictures of my kids and myself on holiday and nice things like that. And that means that at the very least people know if they're engaging with me, that they're engaging with a human being.
Right.
And other people do that as well. There's several people online that I have a very hard time staying relating to. But when they post pictures of their kids and from holidays and of their garden and stuff like that, I remember, you know, this is not someone who is reducible to his or her posts.
Your approach sounds quite calculated, though.
Sometimes it's calculated and sometimes I just fire something out. I'm completely inconsistent, you know.
Some might say awkward.
I'm awkward. Well, actually, having said that, I am careful. I've become very careful because I've had to be careful.
Yeah.
And there are certain things that I know are totally off the table, particularly because I work for two Jewish organisations and I can't do anything that would be reputationally difficult.
Right.
And also, my wife runs a major Jewish institution, and so I have responsibilities to her and I have responsibilities to the kids and stuff like that. So, yeah, I am much more careful than I used to be. I'm much more strategic. There are certain things I don't tweet about. I didn't tweet when there's a flare-up in Israel like there was, sorry, this is going to date the podcast, in Gaza a couple of days ago. I don't post about that, regardless how I feel, simply because...
It doesn't add anything to the conversation?
Well, or? I will put something in if it says something that someone else is not saying. I think there's a lot of repetition. I think maybe the rule of thumb should simply be don't post unless you're saying something that nobody else is saying.
Ooh, yeah, but then...
That's a high bar, though, isn't it?
Right, right. And then I'm pretty sure both Facebook and Twitter will be out of business overnight.
And the problem is... I mean, what would I have to say about what's going on in Gaza that nobody else is saying? If I find something that I could say, then maybe I'll say it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm as lost as everybody else is.
So on that note, buy your book, right?
Yeah, that's a really bad pitch, isn't it? It's an elevator pitch. Buy this book because I've no idea what I'm doing. It's novel.
I thought, well, it is a novel, yeah.
Well, that'll be the next one.
Keith Carn-Harris, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Hayden. Good luck with the podcast as it develops.
Thank you.
Thanks to Keith, and do check out his book, Strange Hate, Antisemitism, Racism and the Limits of Diversity, available from all the places you'd usually buy books. The Bagel is on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, as well as bagelpodcast.com. And yes, I do appreciate the irony. Until next time, Bagelers.